So these reps were making more and more money based upon how many milligrams of morphine they were getting into people's bodies, which is really sick, right? I mean, it's twisted. And it was like kind of culty, you know, they would have these retreats in Miami and, you know, cheesy kind of beachy retreats where all the drug reps and the pharmacists and the doctors would be invited. Everybody would just get wasted and party and, you know, play with these things. Remember this?
Oh, there it is. The old Oxy.
The old OxyContin plushie.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking hot air.
I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually you could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Change Agents, an Ironclad original brought to you by Montana Knife Company. My guest today is Peter Berg. We are going to be talking about his latest Netflix project called Painkiller, which is around exposing the Sackler family and the pharmaceutical industry. Peter Berg is an award-winning actor, director, writer, and producer. He has acted in movies such as Copland, Collateral, Smoke and Aces, The Kingdom, among many others. And he has a very extensive directorial resume, including Friday Night Lights, Lone Survivor, Deepwater Horizon, and Patriot's Day. In his recent work, Painkiller, a Netflix limited series, it uncovers the origin of the opioid crisis in America. The series is available to stream right now on the platform. Painkiller is a limited series based on actual events, and the series investigates the origins of the opioid crisis, starting with the invention of OxyContin by the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma. According to the CDC, 841,000 people died from drug overdoses in the United States from 1999 to 2020. Nearly 500,000 of those deaths were caused by prescription or illicit opioids. OxyContin received approval from the FDA despite not having long-term studies or assessments of its addictive properties. Purdue Pharma currently sits in Chapter 11 bankruptcy and is on the hook to pay out billions of dollars in lawsuit settlements. In 2020, the company pleaded guilty to three federal criminal charges and agreed to pay $8 billion in settlements. Why the Sackler family? How do you pick the projects that you want to dive in on like this?
For me, this guy named Eric Newman, who's a buddy of mine, who's a producer, did the Narcos, kind of created all those Narcos shows and a bunch of other things. I've known him forever. And he was the one who first came to me and, you know, asked me if I knew about the Sacklers, and I did. And he asked me if I was interested. And I started thinking about the people I know who died from opioids, you know, people that were not famous, friends of mine, several people that I knew who, whose kids got caught up in it and went through the hell that a parent goes through when their child, you know, is struggling with addiction, which is really bad. And I started thinking, like, some of the my heroes, my musical heroes in particular, was like Prince when I was coming up in Minnesota, was a huge influence on me. Tom Petty, who I loved, and Chris Cornell, three, you know, musicians that I just, you know, personally connected to and were a big part of my life, all dying of opioids. And I was like, yeah, okay, I'm interested. And then the more I learned about the, you know, this is one specific fucked up part of the reality of our lives, pharma companies and how they can manipulate the FDA to get things approved that probably shouldn't be approved, and how they can make a lot of money. And, you know, I'm not like a big conspiracy guy. You know, if And you want to talk about like the Kennedy assassination. Yeah, there's some things don't line up, and maybe there's stuff at Area 51. I don't know. I never got on there. I tried, but I didn't get on.
God, I hope there's stuff there. I hope there's all sorts of alien shit.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some.
I hope so.
But the more I learned about how that particular family, the Sackler family, was able to basically take heroin in a little M&M pill, you know, prison packaging system, bribe an FDA employee in Curtis Wright, who approved it, knowing what it was, and then just mass release it. And how many people's lives were destroyed and how much money they made. I was like, this is something I want to be a part of. You know, I made a lot of movies now, and I'm not a kid, and I know how much work it is, you know, to people always say, hey man, you want to go make a movie? I'm like, dude, leave me alone. But I know to do it, just to do it, even to do a shitty movie. And I've made a few of them, made some good ones and shitty ones. They're all hard, you know? So for me at this point, I'm looking for, you know, some personal connection to any project, whether it's a documentary, a Super Bowl commercial, or a film. I need to have a reason to, because it's just too hard. And for this one, I felt really kind of loaded up.
Yeah, you know, I reached out to you after I saw you on the most recent time that you were on Joe's podcast, which led me to the Netflix series Painkillers. I figured, I'd turn it on and watch, you know, an hour of it. About, I don't know, 12 hours later, after I had watched every single episode back to back to back to back.
Yeah.
For reasons, I think, probably that you wanted to make the film, we have mutual friends. From my old community that got very deep down the rabbit hole of opiate abuse. And I don't, people have had great experiences with military medicine. People have had really bad experiences. It's a broadsword, not a scalpel. And oftentimes they will, I would say, overprescribe. When I got hurt overseas, they gave me a prescription for opiates, but I'm fortunate. I have a genetic, or I'm unfortunate, depending on how you look at it. I have a genetic blood abnormality where opiates don't work as well for me. So I never had, it makes you constipated, and two, made my stomach upset. So I'm like, I'm done with this. I'd rather deal with the pain.
Right.
But I don't know anybody from the teams that I served with that took it to the point of losing their life over it. But I know some people who lost who they were for long periods of time in their life and had to fight their way back.
Yeah. I mean, I always felt like the SEAL community was uniquely challenged to not lose their fucking minds when they got out. You know, everyone's challenged at all times, it seems, to not lose their minds. But what I observed time and time again was that just the challenge of transitioning, even if it's you're still in the teams, but you're coming back from a deployment, and you've got, you know, family time before you're going to start training up again to go back out. That downtime is so challenging for many reasons, which obviously you know. And then the retirement and the transition into, like, you know, what? I have so much empathy and awareness of when you have a job, you know, and I know pro athletes were, you know, retiring from pro football or pro basketball, seems more football work. You know, I have a boxing gym in LA, and we have UFC fighters who are sort of reaching the tail end of their career. Boxers, same thing. And after a job like pro fighter, Navy SEAL, you know, Super Bowl winning football, like, you're vulnerable, and you're trying to figure out how to, you know, replicate a high career high that's almost impossible to replicate. You can't walk around doing what you did when you were in the teams, I know. So someone gives you some Oxycontin and it feels good. Yeah. You know, fortunately you didn't have that feeling.
And, especially if you go to the VA or even the medical provider in the military, if you tell them that you have pain, they will respond in the way that they are either the most comfortable with or the way that they have been taught. And it's largely prescription based. And it,
yeah.
I truly didn't realize because I, you know, I view the world through my own experiences. I didn't realize how fast the opioids, specifically the OxyContin, actually can get its hooks into you. I thought it would be a exposure over a longer time.
Yeah.
It was very revealing going through the series. And, you know, obviously it's, God, it must have been a fascinating journey for you and your crew to navigate not getting sued into oblivion by, yeah. by Big Pharma.
I'm still waiting for the call.
But think, to go from people who get prescribed from a normal pain management perspective, and the next thing you know, they're scraping off the time release, and the next thing you know, they're crushing the pills up and they're snorting right. it and passed out in cars. My God, I thought that would be years. For some people, they're jumping the shark and going straight to some of those things.
7 days. I mean, one of the many genius, horrific things that Purdue Pharma, the company that makes OxyContin, did, one of their genius, if you're just looking at it purely in terms of how to make a bunch of money, you know, it used to be back in the late 1990s that these opioids existed for end of life or extreme pain, right? Like, you know, you're shot in a battlefield and they're going to give you morphine, right? Or your grandmother has cancer and she's 92 and she's got a month to live and she's in, you know, okay, makes sense. What Richard Sackler, who was sort of the architect of OxyContin, sort of, you know, you ever seen those pain scales with smiley?
0 to 10. Where are you at?
Where are you at, right? And so it used to be, I think they're called the Wonk-Baker, check it, Wonk-Baker test. Like, it was the doctor that invented it. Seems so simple, but it's actually a genius idea, right? Point. And it used to be, you know, OxyContin or opioids were 9, 10. Okay, you're 9 or 10. Well, what Richard Sackler did was, well, let's spread that out. Let's maybe catch anyone that's a 5 or higher, right? So, you know, and it's not to, you know, disrespect real pain, but, you know, the pills started getting prescribed much quicker and easier. So you break a collarbone, here's a prescription of OxyContin, 20 milligrams a pill for a week. And if the pain comes back after a week, we'll do what's called titrating you up. Have you ever heard that one?
Yeah.
I mean, so you take OxyContin for a week and it works pretty good, but after a week, your body gets a little immune to it. You're still feeling pain. Yeah, we're just going to kick you up to 30 milligrams. And now you're pumping 30 milligrams of heroin into your body. One in 10, maybe more, are going to get hooked. And they knew that.
How did they get it approved? I mean, I'm assuming you guys did an immense amount of research.
There's a guy named Curtis Wright who worked for the FDA. And, you know, when you think about like FDA approval, it sounds so official, right? Like,
yeah, like there's a team of scientists nerding out on shit.
Of ethical scientists and, you know, they're being managed in internal affairs and structures that keeps everybody. It was one guy in the case of OxyContin, this guy, Curtis Wright, who originally said, there's no way we're approving this. Like, this is heroin. We're not approving it. We're not saying it's non-addictive. We're not doing any of this. And they rejected. Curtis Wright appeared to have, you know, some ethics and was on the right side of at least saying, hold up. Like, I can't just put an FDA seal of approval on this particular form of heroin. And they were going back and forth and they couldn't get his approval. And the whole drug approval process is interesting because to take a new drug to market costs a fortune.
Yeah.
So if you work, you know, run Purdue and you're going all in on OxyContin as our new product, you've got to test it and test it again and spend a fortune developing it. So Purdue was tens of millions of dollars and they were already in financial trouble. They were all in financially on OxyContin. They needed the approval and they weren't getting it. And in a famous meeting at a hotel on the East Coast, somewhere outside of Virginia, the Purdue reps took Curtis Wright, the man who had said no several times, to a hotel room for 3 days. No one knows what happened in the hotel. But when they came out, he approved. There was an approval of OxyContin with the line, which had never been used before in the history of the FDA, that OxyContin is believed to be non-addictive. Is believed. That, it just makes no sense if you really get into the semantics of that. And they approved it. A year later, Curtis Wright left the FDA, where he was making $50,000 a year, took a job at Purdue Pharma for several hundred thousand dollars a year. And the rest is history.
Is there?
So we weren't allowed to say what happened in that hotel room.
But do you know is the question.
Well, but I know no one knows other than he definitely left his job at $50,000 and went to work for them. And when I was talking to Rogan about, like, I wanted to film what I imagined going on in that room.
Oh,
just
yeah.
The most botcherous Roman spy freak show orgy.
He's just wearing through, like, a dive mask, being bit, like, just being beaten with a shit-filled pantyhose or something like that.
Yeah. And just God only knows what the fuck went on in that room. But, you know, they bribed him.
Yeah.
And I can't say that. I don't have proof, couldn't say it in show. I don't know how you can look at the facts and, you know.
So what you're saying, so again, and I look at this for anybody out there, spoiler alert, I'm not a doctor of any type or scientist. I'd say I'm a reasonable person. So you look at that, a reasonable person, let's draw some breadcrumbs. So there was a hiccup in the approval process. They isolate the guy who's going to approve. Something happens for 72 hours. He works for another year for the FDA. And then goes and works for Purdue Pharma. Is there any level of oversight or culpability in the rearview mirror? I mean, that decision is what launched that medication writ large onto the public. Is there any level of culpability or an organization that's willing to look in the rearview mirror to try to hold anybody accountable for that? Or it's like, oh, it just happened in the past, so it's done.
You know, you start then getting into, like, how did the Department of Justice operate and during this and still to this day, but for the last 20 years, this has been an issue, and a little bit less, that Purdue Pharma has been making billions and billions of dollars and hiding their money offshore, and more people have been dying and families have been ruined. And, you know, where is justice in all of this? And there have been several trials, none of which were able to put like stick in terms of really penalizing Purdue. They were able to avoid serious penalties, financial and criminal, consistently. You know, they've had really good lawyers, from Rudy Giuliani to Mary Jo White.
This episode is also brought to you by Montana Knife Company. This is one of my favorite brands, and I am so proud of the fact that they wanted to be involved with Change Agents. The founder, Josh Smith, one of the most experienced master bladesmiths in the world, has become a personal friend. He lives just a few hours down the road in Frenchtown, Montana, and I have absolutely fallen in love with the Montana Knife Company blades. Josh has been making knives for 30 years, and he founded MKC here in the beautiful state of Montana to create the most functional blades for an outdoor lifestyle, manufactured locally here in Montana. They're designed, tested, and built by hunters. MKC is a hunting knife company, first and foremost, and they produce the sharpest knives out of the box and some of the easiest knives to sharpen. They're a young company, and they're working hard to keep up with demand. If you're familiar with this brand, you know what I'm talking about. From time to time, it can be a challenge to get a hold of some of their blades. And one of the things that is their most requested, and that some people may not even know about, is their culinary set. These knives are unbelievable. I was fortunate enough, and by that I mean I forced them to send me a set of these, or I wasn't going to do the ad read for them. If you're serious about cooking, you need these in your kitchen. These sets are going to be back in stock for Black Friday, but this will be a limited everyday in stock, meaning they're not going to release their full inventory so that they have enough for the holiday gift buying season. If you can get your hands on one of these sets, I cannot say enough good things about them. Also right now, and for the first time ever, they actually have some of their knives in stock full-time on the site. You can go grab yourself a Blackfoot 2.0, a Speedgo, which is my absolute favorite daily driver knife, and a Stonewall Skinner. If you use the code CHANGEAGENTS10, you're going to get 10% off your first order. That is CHANGEAGENTS with 10 at the end of it for 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company, working knives for working people.
I'll tell you a fucked up story. Do you want to hear a good story?
Why would you ask me such a rhetorical question? You know that I'm interested.
Try and follow this, okay? I don't even know if I can make it, because this is when I realized how the game is played and why nobody's like, and say, I'm not a conspiracy guy. But when I read this, when this happened to me, I was like, okay, I get it. I see how it goes. There was a young prosecutor named Brownlee, James Brownlee, who was in charge of going after Purdue, right? All-American, honorable, man of integrity, young prosecutor who was the lead prosecutor, okay? He was going after Purdue on behalf of all the people who had died and families destroyed and all this stuff, right? He was the good guy. He cared about the family members and the dead kids. And all, he was there, the voice of reason and justice and compassion. He was on the Justice Department side, Brownlee. The chief attorney for the Sacklers was a woman named Mary Jo White, right? This was a hard-ass, like, lawyer, didn't care about the ethics, was there for the money. She was going to represent the company that was killing people. The company that was selling OxyContin, Mary Jo against Brownlee. Mary Jo, the bad guy, Brownlee, the good guy, right? Mary Jo won, right? And it was like, wow, you know, this woman is just a killer, tough attorney. And she just represents, you know, everything that you would imagine when you think about unethical lawyers that don't care about the truth. Give me the money and we're going to fucking win this thing, right? Cut to a couple of years ago. You know who Dan Snyder is?
No.
Owner of the Washington Redskins.
Okay. I don't believe they're called that. I don't think they're called that anymore, Mr. Berg.
The Washington Commanders. Well, they were called the Redskins. They were called the Redskins when this started.
Indeed.
Dan Snyder is, and I'm not, this is not a judgment on Dan Snyder, but Dan Snyder was in trouble. And Dan Snyder was being accused of all kinds of bad things. And, you know, in bad work environment, all kinds of, you know, it's all public what he was accused of. And the NFL decides to hire independent counsel to investigate Dan Snyder on behalf of all the cheerleaders that he allegedly harassed and the working people that he harassed. They hire someone that they want to be noble and that is going to go after him. They hire Mary Jo White. Okay? So they hire Mary Jo White. Like, 1 week she's working for the Sacklers. Now she's working for the NFL, protecting the innocent. And I'm like, this is fucking crazy. A month after I hear this, I get a FaceTime from Dan Snyder, who I know. And he knew that I'd been making painkiller. And he said, hey, man, like, what do you know about Mary Jo White? You know, they're investigating me. I'm like, dude, that's a scary, formidable woman. I gotta be careful. He goes, well, I've got good representation. Puts the phone up. It's John Brownlee.
Oh, stop
it. He's now representing Dan. Okay. So the good guys represent, like, and it's like, when I found that out, I was like, they're all a bunch of motherfuckers. They only care about the money. The truth doesn't matter. And it's real. It's actually real. And this whole experience of making painkiller, like, I look at everything through, you know, like, I want to do the defense contractors next, because that's another one that gets me.
Let me know if you need any help with that. I'd be more than happy to burn some of those organizations to the fucking ground.
I mean, it's extraordinary, you know, and you look at all of these wars now, you look at Ukraine and certainly what's going on with Israel, and who's making money, right? Who's making money? And you know the companies, and you know what they sell, and you know what their products are, and you've used them, and you have, friends who died, using these weapons or having these weapons used against them. And I see similarities between both professions, the drugs and the weapons. And I look at stocks, and I've been looking at Boeing and Raytheon, Donald Douglas and others since 3 weeks ago when Israel was attacked, and those numbers are going up.
Yeah.
So I find that to be
there's a whole ecosystem and machine behind it. As you were kind of describing the, good lawyer versus bad lawyer, I'd agree with you. I think at some level or at some point, it just becomes about the check. I think to do that job effectively, you might have to hang up a portion of your soul and just be like, fuck it. I'm just going to represent to the best of my ability. Did the FDA, have they changed that approval process for drugs, or is it still this linchpin of one person that could be manipulated like that?
I think in light of the attention that Curtis writes, I haven't tried to get a drug approved by the FDA, but I would think that certainly with opioids, they're trying. I would imagine they're a little more careful because they got hammered on Curtis Ray. All the other drugs that we're seeing, and supplements, and I still don't understand why the FDA won't approve stem cell, for example, why. Everyone's got to go to South America to get the shots and supposedly work quite well. So yeah. I have yet to get a good answer from anyone that knows stem cells. And I'm sure you do too, people who've gone to Panama or Colombia and gotten.
Or even Mexico. I have a huge contingent. Huge contingent of friends that have gone down to Tijuana to CHPSA, and they're getting life altering results. And they have to cross over into Tijuana. They're literally doing it. I don't know if the topography would support it in being in eyesight of the border, but as the crow flies, it's a couple of miles south of the border. But they have to do that. And I've seen everything from nerve regeneration to disc regeneration to chronic pain. It's insane. And it's a full protocol down there.
Right.
And they can't get it in the U.S. Like, what the fuck are we doing here?
And I've talked to people who, when you try and find out why, will immediately say, well, there's a lot of people that don't want that to work because they're not going to, drug companies, surgeons, there's a list of lobbyists of a good reason to not want a stem cell shot to work. Because of money, I can't prove any of that. But I do know many people from Joe Rogan to Frank and Lorenzo from the UFC to Mel Gibson, who took his dad down, to Panama, I believe, really swear by it.
Yeah. My business partner went down to Mexico twice and did a general, the one where it's not targeted in a joint, but just a general IV delivery. He was born with a genetic abnormality in his heart. Right. And the doctors, when he came back to get checked twice, they cannot explain why I think it's the ejection fractionate was the one that had the main improvement. They can't explain why, but the guy's heart is performing better because of those treatments, but it's illegal in the United States. And I'm not saying
FDA won't approve it. And I don't know why. I don't trust them at all. And after my experience making painkiller, I have no reason to trust them and believe that, I believe that the great majority of their decisions are influenced by lobbyists who are working for parties that have interest in making a lot of money based upon drugs.
One of the things in watching the series, again, that I didn't realize, and I actually found it to be the most disturbing, was the strategy they take with drug reps. And I don't know where the legal boundary is. I would say they've become experts at flirting in the gray area. But could you unpack a little bit the strategy that specifically Purdue Pharma took with doctors and the millions of dollars of bonuses that they paid out to their drug reps?
It was go to college campuses find good looking young graduates, male and female, train them up briefly, send them out into the country to doctors that didn't really have the information, didn't understand what the drug was, and by any means necessary, get these doctors to prescribe. And once they got them to prescribe, the drug reps were all based upon milligrams sold. So they would be motivated to get them to increase the dosage. You know, okay, Andy's doing pretty well on 20 milligrams. Let's get him up 40 milligrams, or he's going to be doing real well, because 40 milligrams of Oxycontin, you're not going to feel anything, right? Take a hammer to your hand repeatedly, and you're cool, man. Everything's good. So these reps were making more and more money based upon how many milligrams of morphine they were getting into people's bodies, which is really sick, right? I mean, it's twisted. And it was like kind of culty, you know. They would have these retreats in Miami, and, you know, cheesy kind of beachy retreats where all the drug reps and the pharmacists and the doctors would be invited. Everybody would just get wasted and party and, you know, play with these things. Remember this?
Oh, there it is. The old Oxy.
The old Oxycontin plushie.
Fuck.
But yeah, I keep him close. You know, it's...
Imagine applying that to my job, where I would get paid more based on the number of rounds that I fired. And I was incentivized. And then I would just be looking for reasons to pull the trigger. And there's a reason why it can't be like that, because it completely convolutes your decision-making process, especially when you're talking about a military ecosystem. I mean, I realize it's conjecture, but do you think that any of these doctors did not realize what they were involved in?
No, I think most of them did. I mean, you, in theory, can't be a doctor without understanding narcotics and the human body's relationship to narcotics. I think that they thought, because the FDA had approved it, that they certainly had like plausible deniability and were kind of following orders, and that they weren't doing anything wrong. Maybe it wasn't right, but by definition, it's not wrong, because so we're cool and we're all getting paid. And, you know, there were doctors who said no. And I think now, you know, in fairness to the truth, there is just in general a greater awareness, so that, you know, when people hear Oxycontin, generally they cringe, and if you have a buddy or a kid who has, you know, a horrific accident, God forbid, and you recognize, okay, he's going to need some painkillers, you're going to be much more vigilant, and you're going to be like, well, okay, doc, how many, what milligram and for how long? Then you're going to be probably making sure that whoever it is in your life that you care about is following that and stopping. And that just didn't used to be the case back in the early 2000s. So people weren't paying attention to it. You know, and like you said, like I would hope that, like in the SEAL community, for example, when a SEAL gets hurt and gets off surgery and gets Oxycontin, I would hope, and I would bet, that the SEAL community in general is a little more vigilant about the pain procedures that person's going to follow getting out, rather than just throwing pills, which I think did happen.
Well, I can't speak to the modern SEAL community, but in 2005, when I got hurt, came back, I had at one time 13 bottles on my sink in my bathroom. And my sister was going through nursing school, and she had asked me about the medications that I was taking. And one day I was sitting there with a resting heart rate of about 150, with a pounding headache, profusely sweating. And my sister was the one who found the negative interaction between multiple of the prescriptions that I was given. And I'm not talking a little bottle. I'm talking a howitzer can of Vicodin or Percocet, or it's like, hey, I'm in pain, and they're like, here you go. And I don't think they were being malicious. I want to be fair to the doctors at the time. It was earlier on in the global war on terror. They weren't used to seeing that type of injury. But when I was in, it was prescribed, and you're kind of on your own. And I would hope that that is changed, because that's how shit spins out of control real, real fast.
Yeah, I don't know, because I'm not current, like, you know, that current to talk to guys who are coming back like now.
Yeah.
But it's just in general, the there's a certain cringe response to the word oxycontin now.
Yeah.
And you really have to be immoral to be throwing opioids at anyone, much less a community like the SEAL community, or the Navy in general.
Yeah, well, we have no governor. We're defined by our lack of governor.
Yeah, I would imagine that like every aspect of our country has woken up a bit to the issues with prescribed opioids. The new issue now, of course, is fentanyl.
Yeah.
And this like psychotic Russian roulette game that every human being who decides to like recreationally use a drug like cocaine is flirting with, you know, their life because they get a hot dose of fentanyl. And that's almost a new and different and in many ways unrelated problem to OxyContin, because this is not being prescribed like OxyContin or Percocet or Vicodin was. And so that's a new issue. But I do think that there has been movement away from throwing opioids at people that are hurt.
Well, I would hope so, given that it killed about 500,000 people over a 21-year time period. I would hope that there was a little bit of a course correction. There's a lot of things I like about the Mountain Tough program, but I think primarily what I enjoy is they focus on mental toughness in addition to just the physical toughness. Everything they do is grounded in one purpose: life transformations and being strong between the years in the mind. And there's also a community of 15,000 plus Mountain Tough athletes. So the community is strong, they're supportive, and they're gonna help keep you accountable. So you can train anywhere, you can stream anywhere, you can access guided training and on-demand workouts right from your phone, your tablet, or TV or computer, whatever you're into. And everything you need is in one spot. The Mountain Tough subscription gets you access to all the Mountain Tough programs, new programs, and bonus content. And they have programs for everyone. Those who hit the gym and heavy weights, those who like to work out at home with no gear or minimal gear, and everything in between. Mountain Tough has been the trusted training by the dedicated for years now, including U.S. military special forces and dedicated backcountry hunters. There is no excuse for you to not start today. With Mountain Tough, you can conquer your goals with the ideal program for your lifestyle and schedule. Train with equipment or just your body weight on your phone, tablet, TV, or web browser. Most importantly, they will help you train your mindset so you are always ready for anything that life throws your way. Mountain Tough subscribers get full access to world-class home and gym programs, groundbreaking mental toughness training, self-improvement, prehab and rehab, biomechanical form coaching, stretching and mobility flows, nutrition guidance, challenge workouts, and the global Mountain Tough community. Mountain Tough is offering Change Agents listeners an incredible offer. You're going to get 40% off on the all-new Mountain Tough Plus annual subscription with the code CHANGEAGENT. Go to mtntough.com and enter the code CHANGEAGENTS to receive 40% off, a savings of about $100 on your Mountain Tough Plus annual subscription. That is MTN, Mike Tango November, tough.com, and enter the code CHANGEAGENTS to save 40%. That is less than 50 cents per day for the best in-class physical and mental training. Hey there, everybody. Before we get back to the interview, if you want to grab a hat or a shirt like the one I'm wearing right now, go visit shop.thisisironclad.com and use the code CHANGEAGENTS. That's going to be all one word, all caps, for 15% off of your order. Ironclad just restocked their inventory, so get them before they're gone. And make sure to follow them anywhere at This Is Ironclad to stay in the know for exclusive collaborations that are going to be coming soon. That's shop.thisisironclad.com, code CHANGEAGENTS. One word, all caps. It's going to get you 15% off of your order. All right, let's get back to the show. you know, each episode opens with a family member or a loved one of somebody talking about what happened. How hard was that, or how moving, I should say, was that for you to sit down with those people and listen to those stories?
I mean, very moving. And the most disturbing, as disturbing as those stories were, you know, with six different parents, sets of parents who had lost a child to OxyContin, as disturbing as that was, what I found equally disturbing was kind of decided to do that at the last minute. We were almost done. You know, we call it locking the shows. Mm-hmm. When done editing, you basically have to turn it over. It's always a traumatic experience for a filmmaker because you're like, give me one more week. You know,
it's your baby.
You're never done. They just take it from you. But I thought it would be a powerful way of representing the standard legal disclaimer. You know, some of what you're going to see is not is interpretive fact rather than fact. So I suggested it to the Netflix lawyers. They said if I could, you know, get the families to agree that they would use that as a disclaimer, but we didn't have any time. And so we basically just put out a casting request in West Los Angeles area for families who had lost someone from a child who were willing to talk and tell their story. And within 2 days, I think we had like 47 families just in the West Los Angeles area. And I they all wanted to come out, you know, and then we're like, well, who do we pick? Like, they were all equally, you know, disturbing and really sad stories. But the amount of people that this epidemic has touched is extraordinary, you know, and it's certainly not limited to the hundreds of thousands of people who literally died, but the amount of people who just had their lives wrecked by this. And, you know, for every person who dies on OxyContin, there's a wake of people who love that person who are forever fucked.
Yeah.
And we felt that when we were doing those opening.
When you were researching this project, which I'm assuming was a substantial period of time and effort, what was the most surprising thing or shocking thing that you actually discovered for yourself, or something that you didn't know that kind of set you back on your heels?
Definitely the FDA being bribed, the FDA worked. I was surprised at how effective. One of the things that the Sackler family did that was quite interesting was deflecting attention or reframing the narrative. Like, it's kind of like the Alfred Nobel story. You know, the Nobel Peace Prize was created by Alfred Nobel, who created dynamite, and was one day his brother died, and a newspaper got confused and ran his obituary, and he read his own obituary, and he was called the Merchant of Death, because that was, you know, his gift to society was dynamite. And he actually invented dynamite thinking it would be good for construction, but not realizing quite, you know, where it's going to go. And you know, he was arguably the architect of the bomb, any bomb. And he realized that this is what his legacy was going to be. And so he started the Nobel Peace Prize as an attempt to shift the perception. Reality is he made his fortune selling dynamite, but he's remembered as this great man of peace and humanity. The Sacklers, and this was, I didn't quite realize how effective they were at it, took all this money that they were making off of OxyContin, and they built wings at museums, art museums all over the world, the Metropolitan, the Guggenheim, the Louvre, many others, and were seen as this, you know, philanthropic family helping to support the arts and provide these beautiful galleries for families to come and appreciate the arts. And they were known as sort of the art family. And then they started building medical schools, different schools, all different campuses all around the country, the Sackler Medical Schools. And they were seen as, you know, education, advancing the cause of, you know, medical research. So they had all these positive, and they were doing it very deliberately. not because they cared about art, but because they cared about the perceptions of name. And it worked for quite a while. Those names have been ripped off all of our museums now, and all of the, and many of them were still up when we started the show. And so I remember going to the Sackler Wing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, which is this beautiful open glass wing that had like an Egyptian pharaoh exhibition with like sarcophagus.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, I've been there recently, actually.
And you've been in there?
It's beautiful.
And I remember going in the first time, kids running around and having fun, and everyone's playing. And I looked over and a guy had taken a knee and was proposing to his girlfriend, you know, in the middle of this. It was this sort of happy, magical place. But there was one little plaque that says the Sackler Wing, Raymond Arthur Mortimer Sackler. And I'm looking at this, knowing where the money for all this came from and how ignorant everyone was to it. People were just having a wonderful day in this beautiful building that was paid for, you know, with the deaths of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people because of Oxycontin. I'm like, this is fucking nuts. I didn't realize, you know, I'd been in that wing with my family when I was a kid, having no idea what it was. And the more research I did on the reality of this family and this drug, you know, this is the kind of thing that opened my eyes.
So I know Purdue is sitting in Chapter 11, but how was the Sackler family themselves? I'm assuming they were able to maintain a lion's share of the multiple billions of dollars they made off of this.
Yeah, so I mean, what happened was, it was interesting because it happened the day our show came out. Which was just a bizarre coincidence. I don't know. Rogan doesn't. Rogan thinks it was all a conspiracy, but I don't know.
He thinks Bigfoot's real too. I mean, let's take everything with a grain.
I know. Bigfoot's real, but what had happened was the Sacklers had agreed and have currently agreed to a roughly $6 billion settlement. So they've agreed to pay one final fee of $6 billion, and that's it. If that money is going to be given out, the different states have filed suit, and then in theory, parceled out to get into drug rehabilitation programs, the families of people whose loved ones have died, $6 billion, which for the Sacklers, who are estimated to be worth $20 billion, and they put this money offshore, that's the interest payments on their fortune.
Yep.
So over several decades, we'll pay $6 billion. It was never going to impact their personal finances. And the deal was, that's all we'll ever pay you. There can never be another lawsuit. And you can never come after our money. That's it. This is our final offer. And that was accepted. And the day our film came out, it was appealed by one state. Supreme Court took the appeal and cited, hold up, not so fast. We don't accept this. It's not legal. You can't hide behind bankruptcy. You can't say, we'll pay you one lump and that's it. So the Supreme Court's paused that decision, which means two things. One, they're not paying the $6 billion right now, which is kind of fucked for people that want that money. But the bigger implication is their nest egg is now in play. So it's conceivable that in the next couple of years, all their money is going to be roped up. And it's even conceivable that some of them could face criminal charges, which was a big decision.
That's a huge decision. You know, it's, again, watching the show, totally binge watch it, and I'm stuck with the parallels, and put out a broad template before people think I'm a conspiracy theorist. Like, I'm one of the most highly vaccinated people on earth from being in the military. They literally run you through a fucking air gun when you're bleeding, and then they jab you in the ass. And
yeah,
I don't care about people's political beliefs or leanings. COVID vaccine saved a lot of lives, could potentially have had a lot of harm. You know, they were making about $1,000 per minute based off of that. And it just seems like, again and again and again, there is too close of an intrinsic tie to profit over safety and efficacy and actual impact on the people that are going to end up taking these things. And I don't know how to fix that.
Yeah. I mean, I got vaccinated for COVID, and I had several friends who were telling me that I was a fool to do it and not to do it. And this was before I'd started filming painkillers before I'd gone quite so deep down the rabbit hole of Big Pharma.
Yeah.
I do not believe that today I would get that vaccination. I will ask a lot more questions. Starting with who's making money off of this and how much are they making? Now, if that $1,000 minute number is accurate, which I bet it is, I'm like, hold up.
Yeah.
So and you know, that like, I just think everyone has to ask a lot more questions about what, you know, if we're concerned with what we're putting into our body, whether it's a supplement, stem cell treatment, vaccination, pain pill, there's questions that you should probably ask yourself and give your kids something. Who's making the money off of it? Who are these people? Who are their competitors? How did they get to a position where their pill is in my hand? Like, and then you can maybe make a slightly more educated decision, but we can't trust, you know, I don't believe you can trust the FDA to make these decisions for you. You have to do a little bit more digging.
Well, and then you read that, you know, the makers of the vaccine, and not to highlight the vaccine specifically, but let's just remove any level of culpability or liability in perpetuity. You know, we'll sign that off so you can rush this to market. You look at whose names are on the patents and the net worth of those individuals. It's kind of the
same.
That's right. I'm not a conspiracy theorist either, but it gets hard for a rational person to not go down this rabbit hole. If people go and they watch your series, they're going to leave it scratching their head going, what the fuck? How did this actually happen? And you can apply that same lens almost to the modern era and that push for that particular vaccine. Not that that was the only
one. For sure.
It's
for sure with the COVID vax, like it was just too quick and it was too required. And there was this like herd mentality that just wanted something to feel like a way out. And this became the way out. And the fact is, there are a lot of pay packages and CEOs of, you know, these drug companies that made a buckload of money off of it. And I would think, I don't know that I would do what I did in 2021 or whenever the vaccines. When did they come out? 2021?
Man, that's a good question. I think 21. But again, you know, you make decisions based off the information you have at the time. You know, you're making the best decision that you can. I don't begrudge people at all for whatever choice that they made, especially if you're in a low risk category, make the decision you want. Just be aware all decisions have consequences and you have to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I just don't know that I would do it again.
What would you, now that you've peeled back the curtain a little bit on the pharmaceutical ecosystem or industry, if you could change based on your knowledge of how things actually come to market. And then of course there's the marketing efforts from the brands with the doctors and the reps and all of those things. What would you change about the system if you were king for a day?
I think the biggest thing that I would focus less on the reps and the FDA and the drug. And I would focus more on our relationship to dealing with addiction, to our relationship to looking out for the people in our lives who are going to get caught up in something. And if it's not this pill, it's going to be that pill. If it's not that pill, it's going to be something else, or this drink, or this, you know, choose your addiction. That we just have because what you're really talking about at the end of the day is addiction. People get addicted to something, you know. In this case, it was opioids. It could be shopping. It could be pornography. It could be gambling, alcohol, whatever it is. And you know, our difficulty untangling from addictions and helping our loved ones untangle from addictions is to me the biggest issue that I came away from. If I know someone that I sense is struggling with anything, I'm much more inquisitive. I'm much more proactive and more inclined to confront those demons and those addictions. Because, you know, someone that's addicted to OxyContin and gets off probably has a propensity for addiction. They're going to find something else. So the issue, I think, is, you know, to go back to how we started this call, like, I know people that are addicted to the news right now that have
Yeah.
You know, Al Jazeera, CNN, Fox, BBC. I'm not talking about myself.
Yeah, and they're losing their fucking minds.
Me, man. But like, I can't stop. I'm addicted to the news, right? Like, you know, it's a problem. And, you know, for our kids that are like scrolling endlessly and going into those vortexes, not that different than the high they're getting off a box of cotton. So for me, I trust that there's always going to be drug companies that are going to try and fuck us over and make money. There's always going to be corrupt elements at the FDA there, but I can't control that. But if you're my friend and I'm worried about you, I'm going to get you shit.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do everything I can to put light on that and not allow it. And that's, you know, one of the many horrible things about opioid addictions is it exists in the dark. You don't know it. You could pop a pill right now. I'm not going to smell it on you. I'm not going to see powder in your nose unless you snort it bad and you don't clean up. But it's a quiet, slow, insidious burn that kind of surrounds the host with this addiction. And it's hard to see coming. So oftentimes by the time you see that your kid is taking whatever, at whatever milligram dose a day, they're deeply hooked. And so it's for me about like eyes wide open now for us to look out for each other, because I don't trust the government's going to do it for us.
Yeah, I'm not so sure the government's going to do shit for anybody other than look out for their own best interests at this point. But I like how you describe that. You know, you're dealing with the root cause of the issue as opposed to the symptom. I would add to it, you know, I would hope that at some point we would be okay as a society, or even just humanity, that and we could get to a place where a little bit of pain and a little bit of being uncomfortable is actually okay. It's essential for growth. If you're at like a 3 on, you know, and maybe you have to go pursue that 3 to go work out or box or do fuck whatever you want to do, Taibo, if you want to get into that shit. Everything in my life of value was not gifted to me. I scraped for it and I fought for it and I worked for
That's
it
right.
and I sacrificed for it. I don't think we're supposed to be at 0 as a human species.
I completely agree with you that like our expectation of living pain-free physical and emotional like existences is absurd, you know, and and I've done it for a while and I'm not new to it, but I'm an ice bath addict. Like it's a real bona fide addiction for me. I do it every morning and I have for 3 years consistently. And you know, one of the things that I do believe is, having experimented with different narcotics in my youth, the feeling, the neurological feeling of putting yourself in, you know, 38 degree water and submerging your head for a couple of minutes a day is a release, a way of dealing with pain and particularly mental, you know, pain or, but I also physical as well, a way of substituting for me. And not what I tell anyone about ice baths is like, you know, if you're going to get addicted to something, if you want to try and get the pain out of your body and without having to go to, you know, a bad addiction or a bad tool, there are things that can help us. They're maybe not as much fun as, you know, staying up all night in a hotel room and partying your brains out in the moment, which still is fun, but an ice bath will get you there. And you just have to be willing to accept a little bit of discomfort to get into it. And I do think the expectation for so many people in our culture today is no pain, take the pain away. What's the quickest way to get the pain out of my system? And that causes a lot of problems.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I cannot recommend enough surfing over to Netflix and watching the entire Painkiller limited series. And if you or someone you know is struggling with a prescription drug addiction, you can contact the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration hotline at 1-800-662-4357. And beyond that, if you are struggling with this, please reach out to somebody. And if you know somebody and you can tell that somebody is struggling with addiction, please reach out to them and be there for them as well. Thanks for listening to Change Agents, an Ironclad original, brought to you by Montana Knife Company. We're going to be back next week with an all-new episode.